Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning local news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, NBA teams strike to protest racial injustice in America. Burgess Owens takes to the stage during the Republican National Convention to introduce himself to a national audience. And Utah County has become the epicenter of medical cannabis users, despite the majority of the county's population voting against the measure that legalized medical cannabis back in 2018. On the phone for the show today, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Bethany Rogers. Good morning and welcome, Bethany.
Good morning.
Also on the phone, we've got Taylor Stevens. Hi and good morning to you, Taylor.
Good morning.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Good morning to you, Robert.
Good morning, Roger.
And we will also very shortly hear from Utah Jazz reporter Andy Larson. Listeners, a reminder that you can join us during the show with your questions and comments by tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. You can also call 801-355-8255 to be a part of the conversation. We're going to do things just a little bit differently on the show today and begin with a recorded segment featuring Salt Lake Tribune reporter, Utah Jazz reporter, that is, Andy Larson, who I spoke with yesterday via Zoom. And then we will come back and get some comments from news columnist Robert Gerke before continuing on to other news of the week. But to start with, here's my conversation about the strike or boycott or postponement, whatever you want to call it, of the NBA playoffs with Utah Jazz reporter Andy Larson. Take a listen. Andy Larson, Utah Jazz reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
You know, this week we are talking about the Utah Jazz, though normally or lately we've been digging into your columns on the scientific research around the pandemic. But Andy, the big news this week in the NBA is a short strike, I guess, by NBA teams to protest racial injustice and also a specific police shooting. This starts with one team deciding not to take the court, right?
Yeah. So yesterday, the Milwaukee Bucks were scheduled to play the Orlando Magic in game five of their first round playoff series. And of course, the Milwaukee Bucks are located, their arena is just about 35, 40 minutes away from Kenosha, Wisconsin, where Jacob Blake was shot a couple of days ago. And as kind of in a culmination of all this, you know, what they consider to be police brutality, they decided to not take the court. They decided the best course of action to bring attention to the cause as well as to influence direct change was to not take the court and instead use that time to actually call the Washington Lieutenant Governor and the Attorney General there. Wisconsin, I should say. So, you know, basically they took that step. The Orlando Magic then went off the court in kind of support of what the Bucks protest. And from there, the other NBA teams decided not to protest. The NBA actually postponed all the games.
Decided not to play. Yeah, sorry. I heard you say protest.
Yeah, sorry. Not to play. I apologize. And so, you know, from there, it was the entire NBA schedule for yesterday, for Thursday and Wednesday were both canceled. I guess postponed to a later date is really they will push the games back and looks now likely that they will play Friday. But that's kind of still a little bit up in the air as to how exactly the schedule will play out.
This is a first, right? I mean, this has never happened before in the NBA, even just one team refusing to play a playoffs game, let alone, you know, a whole bunch of teams saying, yeah, solidarity, we're in this with you and we want to see change made.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, the only time that this happened, even in regular season action, was in 1961 when Bill Russell pulled his Boston Celtics team off the court to protest back then racial injustice. So there's kind of this 60-year history of, you know, doing this at kind of the most important times, right? But yeah, in terms of has this happened in a playoff game before or does this regularly happen? I mean, we're talking, yeah, once every 60 years.
Wow. And the Utah Jazz, just to bring it locally, players and the organization expressed support for the strike. As you said, they didn't take the court on Thursday, but they also spoke. I mean, Donovan Mitchell, for example, point guard and, you know, star player for the Utah Jazz, has been very vocal about his anger and despondency over police shootings. Can you talk about what he has said on this topic and his objections to, to racial injustice in the United States?
Yeah, you know, so we spoke to him about it after Tuesday's game, the most recent game the Jazz played, and then also spoke to Rudy Gobert and Jordan Clarkson on Wednesday. And what we found is that these young men all kind of feel that despite their status as, you know, rich Black athletes, and, you know, they're clearly kind of high up in the socioeconomic stratosphere here, they still feel like, you know, walking around in their communities that they could be a target of this kind of violence, or and especially their loved ones could be as well, kind of without that fame to their name. So they feel like when these acts of violence occur against Black people in America, that, you know, they feel a kinship with those people. And so I think that's they're clearly emotional about it when they speak. You know, I think you see a lot of and hear a lot of emotion in their voices when you talk to them about this topic, because I think it is personal to them that they are worried about what's going on in their communities.
And a number of them, I mean, a number of Black athletes in the NBA have very direct experience with racial profiling, with bad interactions with police because of the color of their skin.
Yeah, and in particular, the Milwaukee Bucks do. I mean, so 2 years ago, Sterling Brown, a wing player for them, parked incorrectly in a Walgreens parking lot in the Milwaukee area. And a disagreement with officers ensued, and basically they tackled Sterling Brown, then held a knee to his neck and actually stepped on his ankle and punched him, according to his report, during this police action. One of the police officers was fired as a result of what happened, and there's still a civil suit pending in that case. Former Jazz player Thabo Sefolosha, who actually the Bucks coach now, was the coach of in Atlanta when this happened, had his leg broken by the New York City Police Department and kind of a nightclub altercation where I believe the official word is that Sefolosha said something to one of the officers, and then the officer retaliated by swinging his baton at his leg. Sefolosha sued the city and got a settlement of $4 million. Former Buck John Henson, I mean, I can keep going with these stories because there are just a lot of them, but former Buck John Henson was shopping for jewelry, and a store employee kicked him out essentially because of racial profiling. And called the cops because it was, you know, a tall Black man in a place where the store employee did not expect that. And the store actually ended up apologizing later for the profiling. So there are these clear and you know, that's just kind of three examples tied to this one team that chose to protest yesterday. But there are kind of these, there are all sorts of these examples throughout the NBA and really throughout professional sports and I guess Black lives generally, which is, has led to this movement overall.
Yeah, and there's Donovan Mitchell had this Players Tribune piece that he wrote, I guess, maybe several weeks ago.
I believe.
Yeah, but it was. I mean, it touched on the fact that this is something that nearly every Black player in the NBA has some kind of experience with, and he had, you know, his own experience, I think, from college days.
Yeah, and he talked about, you know, the police officers coming up to him and saying, you know, arresting him and his friends on the way to a basketball game, pulling over, I should say, and the police officer was very confrontational and aggressive until he went back and learned that they were Louisville basketball players and said, "Oh, I love your coach. I love what your coach does." And, you know, for those guys to see the complete 180 once they learned that there was, you know, a kind of basketball related motive, they know how differently that interaction could have gone if they weren't basketball players. And of course, you know, their friends, family, and loved ones don't have that level of fame. They're not necessarily as protected as maybe, say, a Donovan Mitchell is in Utah.
This strike that starts in the NBA, I mean, the postponement of games, people not taking the court, it spreads to other leagues. The WNBA, Major League Baseball, games were canceled there. Also, a game between Real Salt Lake and LA was postponed. I guess, Andy, a question that I have for you is, as someone who has covered sports for a while, do you think that we've hit a point where we'll see this a lot more frequently going forward, a lot more activism from players? And I know that they've gotten blowback online and elsewhere for that, but I just want to let's tackle that first question primarily. You know, are we going to see this happening more and more frequently?
Yeah, you know, I think so. And I think one of the things that's happened in kind of modern sports society is that the players have realized what collective power they have, that they do have this bargaining voice at the table that people in, you know, and that quite frankly, most Black men in America simply do not have. You know, Donovan Mitchell can get a meeting with anyone in Utah at any point that he wants in a way that nearly anyone else can. And so I think realizing that they have that kind of power in terms of deciding when and where to use their talents and deciding how to kind of best use their voices in order to enact change in the community is something that has been kind of growing for a long time now, from, you know, LeBron James to, you know, I think it really just kind of has been a steady growth in that area. So I do think that this will continue. You know, I don't think we're going to see players protest and boycott games on a regular basis, but I think we will see players continue to use their voices and really try to use it to impact change in their communities, not necessarily just be a kind of a figurehead for what's going on.
Well, and sports stars, I mean, that collective power stands kind of in contrast to, you know, one individual like Colin Kaepernick, who gets ousted from his league for, you know, more or less ousted from his league for being the standalone guy. In this instance, you have the league, you have the teams, all of them backing up the players on this, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I would say 99% of the leagues and owners have backed the players in these situations, at least publicly. You know, privately, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. The one exception, quite frankly, was Real Salt Lake owner Deloy Hansen, who went on a radio station Thursday morning to express his disappointment at the protest and say that he was less willing to kind of invest in his team as a result of this public action by the player. So again, it's not, I would say most of the feedback has been supportive. Most of it has been very positive, but there are still clear pockets where the support has been negative, both from fans and some levels of management. And I think that's kind of what the players feel, you know, need to be addressed until kind of everyone can get behind the ending of racial inequality in locally and in America.
And Andy, just on that last point, and we'll wrap up here, but, you know, you wrote about, aside from just Deloy Hansen, but, you know, fans of the Utah Jazz being unhappy about activism by players. And so, the, you know, the team and the players got some flack. And you had some comments from Rudy Gobert on that front that I thought were pretty interesting about making, you know, specifically about making people, fans out there, feel uncomfortable, that that's the point.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think they realize that these messages are going to be uncomfortable for some people, that they are willing to lose fans if their fans aren't willing to support them, not only just as basketball players, but as human beings as well. And I think they think that that level of discomfort with what's going on can lead to change, that, you know, quite frankly, that right now, your average everyday white person is too comfortable with the set of circumstances that we have here. And so given that the Black players don't feel comfortable, they're kind of sharing that discomfort in order to try to affect change.
Just final thing, Andy, the playoffs, we think are going to come back online today, Friday, meaning the day that this airs on Friday.
Yeah, that is the current proposed understanding. That is contingent as of right now on kind of what the owners decide to do as far as, again, affecting change in their individual communities. They're meeting right now to try to kind of figure those issues out and figure out a plan of action that goes beyond the players sitting out games. And obviously, a lot of these owners have huge influence in the communities in which they own teams. And so being able to kind of leverage that is kind of been the player's goal. And I think so long as the owners come up with something that is significant movement in the eyes of the players, that they'll be willing to play on Friday, Saturday, and kind of keep the same schedule moving forward, but delay just a couple of days for what happened this week.
Andy Larson is a Utah Jazz reporter with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for making time for this.
Yeah, thanks again.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. And Robert Gierke, news columnist, one of the things that Andy Larson said towards the end of that segment there was that these players, you know, these teams, the league even, could lose some fans as a result of their activism. But for people like Donovan Mitchell, there are bigger fish to fry, more important things than basketball. That's something that you wrote about in a column this week, and I'll just give you the final say on this before we head to our first break in the show. What, what did you write about on this topic?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's obviously a risk that they're going to lose fans, but I don't think that's as important to them as the point that they're trying to make about racial injustice, police violence, and inequality. And it's an important point, and it's something that sports has frequently let out on. When you look through the history about sort of social activism, racial activism in sports, you know, you've got a whole list of people starting, you know, I mean, including Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Russell, you know, and now LeBron James, Donovan Mitchell, all of these other players, and there is some validity, I guess, to the notion that these are privileged people. They do have status, and as a consequence of that privilege, I think they have an obligation, or feel an obligation, to speak out and use the platform that they've been given to advocate for equality. And you know, I think to argue that they shouldn't be doing that is to argue against the message that they're trying to convey and argue against equality. So if people are going to be upset when they speak out like this, you know, you've got to question if they're actual fans or not. You can't just support somebody, you know, when they dribble the ball, you know, when they can't just support them on the court. As I said in my piece, you've got to support them as a human being, isn't it? As a whole human being, and understand what they're saying. And so, you know, they're not necessarily advocating for themselves, although I think Andy made a compelling case that they aren't exempt from mistreatment and suspicion and harassment.
Right.
But they're sort of a microcosm of all of these people in our society who are struggling for equality. And I think that it's refreshing, I think, to see them using the platform they've been given to give voice to that.
Robert Gerke is a news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, and you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break and then return to talk about the Utah Republican who introduced himself to a national audience this week during the Republican National Convention. Stay with us.
Next time on the Moth Radio Hour.
Do your worst, paparazzi. You are not going to shame me off the beach. I'm going to go down to Bondi along with the supermodels and the muscle men. I'm going to wear my wet, clingy bathers, and there's not a freaking thing you can do about it.
Join us for more true stories told live on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tune in Friday morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
The Republican National Convention was this week with a surprisingly diverse presentation. They told all kinds of lies, not just white ones. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we provide the audience response they sadly lack and talk to SNL star Cecily Strong about how excited she is to play Melania for 4 more years. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Saturday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Bethany Rogers and Taylor Stevens, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning news roundup. Join us with your questions and comments by tweeting to us. Our handle is @KCPW. You can also call us. The number is 801-355-8255. On to some political news now. And Taylor Stevens, the Republican National Convention wrapped up last night. Last night, Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes spoke in sort of a last-minute slot, and maybe we can get to that. But the night before that, Wednesday night, Burgess Owens, Republican candidate for a hotly contended congressional seat, the District 4 seat, he spoke and sort of introduced himself to the nation, or at least to, you know, Republican America during the Republican National Convention. What did Burgess Owens say?
Yeah, Burgess Owens took this opportunity to really talk about his life story. He spoke of his great-great-grandfather, who he said came to the United States on a slave ship and was sold on an auction block. And he talked a lot about opportunity in America, that his great-great-grandfather was able to escape through the Underground Railroad. He went on to become a successful entrepreneur. And Owens kind of makes a connection there between him and his life. You know, he was a former professional football player, and he says that he was taught that anything is possible in America, even though he grew up in the era of Jim Crow. But after his time in the NFL with the New York Jets, he started his own business, and he says that it failed spectacularly, that he was financially ruined, had to move his family into a one-bedroom basement apartment, and eventually through hard work as a chimney sweep and a security guard, he was able to make it again. He says, we live in a country where we're encouraged to dream big, where second chances are the core of our DNA. And he says that the Republican Party is the party that upholds that dream that him and his great-great-grandfather were able to accomplish.
I want to talk about the sort of District 4 race a little bit, but first, you know, there were a couple of points of, you might call it, controversy leading up to this appearance. One was the arrest of the president's former chief strategist, Steve Bannon. Bannon was part of this nonprofit that was founded to supposedly build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, but it is alleged that Bannon spent, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of that money that was raised for that effort on his own personal finances. Anyway, there's a Burgess Owens tie to this story. Taylor, what is that tie?
Yeah, so Burgess Owens had, as you mentioned, come under fire for quite a few different controversies in the last week, and one of them was his connections to We Build the Wall. He'd helped promote that effort, and as the members were, you know, recently charged federally with fraud, that raised some questions, especially for some Democrats in the state. Alliance for a Better Utah, which is a progressive organization involved in politics, criticized his appearance in an online wallathon last summer where he was encouraging donations. They said that he should apologize for his appearance and that, you know, hitching himself to this scam. This is a quote from Chase Thomas, who's the executive director of Alliance for Better Utah. He says, hitching himself to this scam that was doomed to fail from the beginning certainly calls into question his fitness to represent Utahns, and the offensive anti-immigrant rhetoric he helped spread makes it even worse. So he came under some criticism for that appearance.
And, right, what there's this, prior to his appearance, a former Republican lawmaker was calling for the RNC, the Republican National Convention or Committee, to cancel his slot because of some connections that Owens has to this bizarre conspiracy theory group. Taylor, can you just actually talk about that conspiracy theory group and how Owens is sort of tied to it?
Yeah, so QAnon, which is, you know, this baseless pro-Trump conspiracy theory, once relegated to kind of the fringe corners of the internet, but in recent months, as more people have been online with the coronavirus pandemic, it's kind of made its way into the mainstream. But Owens had appeared earlier this summer prior to the primary election on a YouTube show that's connected with the QAnon group. During his appearance on the show, they didn't talk about any of the tenets of QAnon, but he said at the end of the show that, you know, I'm just on the team. And that has raised some questions and concerns among the McAdams campaign, Ben McAdams, his opponent, as well as you mentioned, a former Republican who was a national Republican delegate, that's Cheryl Allen, and she called earlier this week for the Republican National Committee to strip Burgess Owens of his speaking platform because of these ties to QAnon. I should state that I asked Burgess Owens about this, and he says that when he went on the show, he didn't know what QAnon was, and that this is one of hundreds of speaking engagements that he's been on, and he denounced the platform of QAnon. However, Cheryl Allen says that even occasional acknowledgement or participation in anything related to QAnon is irresponsible and should be enough for him to be removed, which clearly he was not. He did speak on Wednesday.
You know, part of the sort of, I think, hope from the Owens campaign with this appearance in front of It's funny to be talking about the Owens campaign in this race because there was another Owens who ran for this this seat and lost as a Democrat a few years back. And so, but anyways, Burgess Owens, you know, going in front of a national audience was maybe hoping to get a fundraising bump. You know, I think that McAdams, you know, in addition to having the kind of incumbent's advantage, he's also got a fundraising lead in this race. Is that true? And has this appearance helped Owens at all on that front? Do we know?
Yeah, that's right. McAdams does have a fundraising advantage, but this is going to be a really close race. This is one of the most competitive races in the country, one of the closest watched. And actually, it was interesting. Owens didn't, I think, say the word Utah once, and I don't think he introduced himself as a congressional candidate. However, I did see many tweets on kind of a national scale of people who praising Owens for his appearance. And so in that way, it does lift his platform, lift his profile among Republicans. But I haven't seen any numbers yet that indicate that this has helped him, but it certainly couldn't hurt
sure.
to go on and make your case to the Republican Party on a national scale.
You know, in addition to his own sort of personal biography and background during this speech, like so many of the Republicans who spoke at this convention, did he bring up that idea of law and order? Was that part of his speech? You know, what Republicans are trying to do in America? That was sort of the theme of the convention, is my understanding.
Yeah, he did. He characterized Trump as the candidate who would reject the mob mentality, quote unquote, and lawlessness taking place around the country in reference to these social justice protests. However, I would say that his particular speech was less focused on that element and more focused on race and opportunity in America. So that was kind of a one segment, kind of a throw-in of this broader speech that was making sort of an argument for, I would say, you know, he encouraged Democrats, independents to vote for Trump in November and kind of made a case that Trump is the best candidate for Black Americans.
Okay. I want to bring in the news columnist Robert Gerke on this. And Robert Gerke, you wrote about Burgess Owens and well, I'll just read the headline. You say that Burgess Owens is realizing that politics is a contact sport, just like the NFL, and he was a former NFL player. How is politics ending up being a contact sport for Burgess Owens, Robert Gerke?
Well, I mean, I think you touched on a couple of the issues that have been raised about Burgess Owens as a candidate, and each time these issues get raised, he blames the liberal media and socialists and communists and so forth. And you know, rather than recognizing that I think these are oftentimes legitimate issues to be raised and part of the normal vetting process that candidates go through. I mean, he's relatively unknown in this state. He's not run for political office before. And so it's normal, I think, for both the media and for his opponents, you know, both the Democrats and Republicans, go to great lengths to vet candidates and dig through their histories to, you know, partly for political purposes in the case of the opposition party, right? I mean, you can bet that Republicans are, you know, digging into Ben McAdams' past. And, you know, and Burgess earlier complained that the Democrats had a tracker on him. A tracker is oftentimes an intern or a staffer who goes to his events and takes video. But, you know, Republicans have had a tracker on Ben McAdams for months. And so this is just part of the normal process. And it's not, you know, it's not touch football, so to speak. It can be, you know, you can get hit hard. And so rather than complain about, you know, the liberal media conspiracy or the socialist Democrats coming at you, I think you need to recognize that this comes with the territory.
Taylor Stevens, bringing you back into the conversation, just when we look at the, you know, the actual congressional race between McAdams and Owens, is there much polling that's been done? What does the race look like right now?
Yeah, the latest polling that we have show that they're neck and neck, that it's going to be a close race, and that's polling that comes from the Deseret News, the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Handicappers at the Cook Political Report recently changed their thought about the race from leaning Democratic, I believe, is what they had before, to a toss-up. So it's going to be a close race. And we saw that in 2018 when McAdams won the seat. He beat Republican Representative Mia Love by fewer than 700 votes. And that was a nail-biter race that was kind of going back and forth and as the votes were counted. So I think we're expecting something similar in this race as well.
And forever a very expensive race as well, sometimes the most expensive race in the nation. Taylor, after the speech, the president, as you might expect, gave some props. He threw some support behind Owens. President Donald Trump did. Is that right?
So he has endorsed Owens prior to this appearance.
Okay.
He endorsed Owens after the primary and said that, that he was a great candidate and that Utah had chosen well.
I'm sure we could go all sorts of places with this, but in the interest of time, is there maybe, one part of this that we're missing that you want to mention, or have we covered it pretty well, Taylor?
I would say that the last thing that we might mention, just in keeping with some of these controversies leading up to the Republican convention, most recently Owens had come under fire for a report from the nonprofit group Media Matters, a progressive organization, that he'd plagiarized sections of his newest book, Why I Stand, From Freedom to the Killing Fields of Socialism. And so, just kind of part of this vetting process that Robert mentioned, that was one of the conversations leading up to the convention, was about that supposed plagiarism.
Gerke, do you want to comment on that? I mean, the digging into people's, any political candidate's past seems it's, as you said, it's a contact sport.
Yeah. The book thing in particular, Media Matters, sort of scoured through the book and compared it against passages and found that there had been large sections that appeared to have been taken from Wikipedia. The campaign said that those sections were footnoted or endnoted and with credit accreditation either to articles that were that he had taken sections from, oftentimes many paragraphs, or from the Wikipedia pages. And so, again, this is just part of the normal process, I think, that he's going to have to encounter. And as Taylor mentioned, this is one of the premier races in the country this year. I mean, it was a close race last time. It'll be a close race this time. And Burgess should get a boost out of this, I think. We saw this with Mia Love when she spoke at the Republican National Convention in a fairly high-profile spot. It gives you a national profile, elevates your platform for raising money, and, we'll probably help his campaign to a degree that we'll have to wait and see when the financial reports come out.
All right. Taylor Stevens, thanks for covering the story for us. And Robert Gerke is a news columnist with the Tribune. Listeners, reminder that you can join this conversation by tweeting to us. Our handle on Twitter is @KCPW. We have more to cover. I'm going to put off our next break a little bit longer, and let's bring reporter Bethany Rogers into this conversation finally. Bethany, this week you returned to a beat that you were covering pretty regularly for a while, the medical cannabis beat, and that's because you were able to get your hands on some data showing where most medical cannabis users in Utah are located. Tell us about that data, Bethany, and what the details are there.
Yeah, so in a presentation to state lawmakers last week, the Department of Health gave this summary of how the medical cannabis program is going 6 months in. The program kind of kicked off issuing patient cards and opening the first medical cannabis pharmacy where people could buy cannabis legally here in Utah about 6 months ago. And so far, they report that more than 8,000 people have patient cards at this point, so about 8,200. And the thing that jumped out to me initially was where those cards were issued. So I was expecting Salt Lake County, as the most populous county in the state, would have the most, but it turns out that Utah County actually holds the most cannabis cards, having about 44% of the cards, with Salt Lake County actually pretty far behind with only 29% of the patient cards in the state.
The reasons why are that's something I want to get to, but just again, this county, Utah County, This is where the ballot initiative to legalize medical cannabis was most soundly rejected, right? That this was the place that was not in favor of medical cannabis use.
Yeah, that was the other kind of surprising aspect, is that it was a 2-to-1 vote against rejecting Proposition 2, the Medical Cannabis Initiative in Utah County. So it's kind of an interesting thing to see that this is where it seems like people have most embraced, at least, you know, getting their patient cards and being able to go and buy medical cannabis at the pharmacies that have begun to open in the state.
You know, is there a typical usage for medical marijuana, for medical cannabis? Your story actually starts with the story of a massage therapist in Orem who uses it to treat seizures, but it's used for any number of things, correct?
Yeah, that was another part of the presentation that state lawmakers heard. There's a breakdown of what conditions people are getting these cards for. And it turns out the vast majority, about 3/4, are getting them to treat some form of chronic pain. And then the next condition on the list is actually PTSD. Epilepsy is another reason that people are getting these cards, but it actually only accounts for about 1% of the cards that people have gotten so far.
And you spoke to a Utah County commissioner who was, pretty gung-ho. He's happy about the fact that there is as much use in Utah County of medical cannabis as there is, because he thinks that it's maybe addressing another problem that Utah County has struggled with. Can you tell us about that?
So Commissioner Nathan Ivey was pretty, as you said, excited to see these statistics, saying that it's a really good thing that people are maybe seeking something besides opioids to treat their chronic pain. He's been very concerned about the prevalence of opioid use in Utah County, the levels of, dependency and addiction, and just, has been looking for less prescribing of opioids. And so he was pretty happy to learn that that a lot of people in Utah County are kind of deciding to embrace getting a patient card. And it seems like there is something to this, with the fact, as I mentioned earlier, that about 3/4 of the cardholders are seeking to treat some form of chronic pain. So you'd think that in some of those cases, they'd possibly be deciding to choose cannabis over some form of prescription painkiller.
Hmm. Utah County has a high percentage of members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and your story touches on the history of the church's opposition to medical cannabis, or to the ballot initiative. Has the church, sort of changed its position? Is it okay with its members legally using medical cannabis?
Yeah, so there was a recent update to the church's handbook that clarified that it's okay to use medical cannabis on the advice of a doctor, and as long as you use it within the dosage guidelines that your doctor gives you and in the form that the doctor gives you. It still says that smoking or vaping cannabis is not allowed. And I mean, the medical cannabis program here in Utah doesn't allow for smoking either, so that's not really even an option.
Right.
But it does clarify that that it's okay as long as you do it under the guidance and supervision of a doctor. And I do want to note that even though the church was opposed to Proposition 2, even back when all of this happened, their stance was not that they were opposed to medical cannabis overall, and they were part of entering that that compromise that ended up being passed after Proposition 2 was approved,
right,
by lawmakers to replace Proposition 2. And that bill, that compromise legislation, is what's given rise to Utah's current medical cannabis program. So it's kind of a nuanced position.
Right. It's not black and white, and on-off binary. You mentioned the patient cards, and maybe I'll just ask you to remind listeners how this process works, how people actually get prescribed medical cannabis in Utah.
Yeah, so the first thing that someone has to do is go into a doctor. They have to have some sort of qualifying condition. There's a whole list of conditions in state law. Some of them I mentioned before. And if you have one of those qualifying conditions, you go online. The Department of Health has a website set up for the medical cannabis program, and they have like a patient portal that you can go in and enter your information and fill it out, and then you sort of send that application over to your physician, and your physician sort of has to sign off on not only that you actually have this condition, but also that your physician recommends that you receive a card so that you can use medical cannabis to treat that condition. So then that goes back to the patient. The patient pays a fee. The state takes a look at the whole thing and then issues the card if you get approved.
Okay. You know, Bethany, I mentioned, and we have to go to a break here in just a minute, but we I mentioned the fact that Nathan Ivey, Utah County Commissioner, was pleased with the fact that there's high usage of medical cannabis, or that that's where, you know, most people who have these cards are 44% are getting medical cannabis. But there are those in Utah County who are less happy with it because they're sort of concerned about what it might lead to. You mentioned a health official there.
Yeah, I spoke with a health official there who said that she wouldn't necessarily discourage someone from getting a cannabis card if that's what their doctor advised, but that the statistic overall kind of concerned her because she wondered why Utah County had so many more patient cards than other counties in Utah and what was really going on there. And I guess her concern, she specializes in prevention of substance misuse, and her concern is that, you know, that some of this medical cannabis could find its way into maybe the hands of children or the black market or sort of get diverted into, you know, into an illicit use. And that, you know, with more prevalence of this use, that there's a higher chance of that. So I think that was kind of where she was coming from.
Okay. Columnist Robert Gerke, any comments on on the fact that there are more medical cannabis users in Utah County than elsewhere?
The surprising statistic, right? And the other one thing that I think is worth focusing on is the 8,000 cards that are out there. It probably isn't as many as I would have expected, but I think it shows that there is significant interest in the program, and the people, despite some of the, you know, obstacles that have been erected or the process that, you know, that Bethany referenced, are taking advantage of this program and hopefully benefiting from it. You know, it's been a long fight to get to where we are now. But if we're alleviating people's pain and ailments, then I think it's on the whole a good program.
Okay, Salt Lake Tribune News columnist Robert Gerke there. We're going to take our second break of the show, and when we come back, we will turn to the Inland Port, if you remember that, and also eventually turn to our underplayed stories of the week. This is Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. Back in a moment.
UPR programming is supported by our members and Utah State University Extension, providing tips for food preservation, including dehydration, pressure canning, and freezing. Information can be found at canning.usu.edu.
What can the brain of one of the greatest geniuses that humanity has ever produced tell us?
On the next Radiolab,
solve the mystery of genius in Einstein's brain.
This is the brain that changed the world.
Every deep insight happened inside that gloppy, gray, 3 or 4 pound structure.
Join us for the third episode in our 4-part series on the concept of intelligence on the next Radiolab.
Tomorrow morning at 11 here on Utah Public Radio. And you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on UPR. Stay with us. We have UPR Presents with an episode of Helga coming up at 10 o'clock.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Bethany Rogers, Taylor Stevens, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. You can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW to comment on the stories we're covering today. Taylor Stevens, to you again, and a story that is as much about a controversial project as it is about a longstanding player here in northern Utah, the Kennecott Copper Mine. The project is the Utah Inland Port, something that environmental and community groups have been opposing. And now those same groups are hoping to convince Rio Tinto Kennecott to help them in putting a damper on this project. They wrote a letter to the mining company. Tell us about this story, Taylor.
Yeah, as you mentioned, these environmentalists, these groups have been opposed to the port for a long time. And this letter kind of represents a shift in tactics a little bit for the group away from sort of coming and speaking during public comment to the 11-member Inland Port Board and toward trying to raise more awareness of these various property owners. And Rio Tinto Kennecott is one of the largest property owners in the Inland Port area, and the Stop the Polluting Port Coalition is, as you mentioned, trying to convince the organization to put the land that it has within the Inland Port jurisdiction into a permanent conservation easement.
Who is the Stop the Polluting Port Coalition? Who comprises that?
Of a couple of different groups. One of the main leaders, Dita Seed, is with the Campaign for Biological Diversity. It's also Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, SLC Air Protectors, a lot of different groups, mostly volunteers who are working around this issue, but from all different types of organizations in the state. And you know, as I mentioned, they want to see this environmental easement. They argue that doing so would help protect air quality and mitigate traffic concerns in the Salt Lake Valley. Those are two big concerns they have with this massive project, which the state kind of envisions as an import and export hub that could help distribute goods throughout the state and get them out to international markets easier.
You wrote that this letter that was sent to Rio Tinto's CEO and I think copied to the city and other officials was signed by 28 organizations, a number of, I guess, environmental and community groups, not just the specific Stop the Polluting Port Coalition, or are all of those groups part of that coalition?
I think several are part of the coalition, but I don't think necessarily all of them are.
Got it.
I'm unsure, though. They all could be part of it. It's kind of a moving target, and they've definitely, the Stop the Polluting Port Coalition has certainly increased its ranks over the past few months as they've put more pressure on this project.
What has the company responded to this letter that was sent?
Yes. So Rio Tinto Kennecott said in a statement that the state has established a clear vision for what the Inland Port is going to be. They say that the Inland Port Authority is the place that state leaders have established where they can gain public input for the project. They say, while we are not acting as a developer, Kennecott will continue to actively engage with the Inland Port Authority, potential purchasers of our property, and community members to encourage sustainable development, environmental protections, and positive conservation outcomes. So not the response that the Stop the Polluting Port Coalition and these other community organizations would have liked to receive. But I think for the members of the coalition, they really just want to raise awareness that Rio Tinto Kennecott is one of these big landowners, and maybe, you know, have a different angle of encouraging opposition to the project.
And one of the things that this letter pointed out, Taylor, if I'm not mistaken, was the sort of history or impact of historic mining and Kennecott, the copper mine's environmental impact in the state. Can you talk about that as well?
Yeah, so they talk about acid plumes and the Bingham Canyon mine being one of the largest sources of toxic releases in the United States, according to the EPA. And they just argue, you know, Rio Tinto can't undo that damage, but what it can do is preserve this land and not do more damage. And they say that doing that would be more beneficial to the state in the long run than the organizations. I believe they have a soccer field or, you know, some of their other contributions to the state, their natural history museum. They say preserving this land would be the best and greatest legacy that you could give to future generations of Utahns, and also kind of, you know, a way to make up for some of the environmental damages that you've done. I should note that in, you know, Rio Tinto, in the state's business plan, the Port Authority's business plan for this area, that states that Rio Tinto is an advocate for environmental sustainability, and Rio Tinto is working to become carbon neutral by 2030. So they're already doing some work, they say, to kind of mitigate for some of the environmental issues that they've caused. But this is what the Port Coalition, Stop the Polluting Port Coalition, would like to see, is just don't develop this land. You're the property owner. You can decide to do that.
Taylor, can you give us just a quick status update? I mean, we actually have to head to our underplayed stories momentarily, but where is the Inland Port? I mean, how is it at what stage in the process are we with the Inland Port?
So the port earlier this summer in May released its long-awaited business plan, which kind of outlines how they envision the port project moving forward. They've passed and approved that. Now we're kind of waiting for the next Inland Port board meeting. The board is not meeting as frequently as it once was, and so I'm not really sure what is going on. We're trying to find out kind of what's going on behind the scenes, but what we hear is that, you know, they're working to establish some policies and procedures and kind of set the stage for moving forward with this development.
With that, I didn't give Robert Gerke a chance to opine on this, but we're going to have to head to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. Thanks, Taylor Stevens, for your reporting on this, and I'll point listeners to her story at sltrib.com. Gerke, how about we start with you for an underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, sure. So this week, we've seen debates over mask mandates playing out across the state. Surprisingly, the Provo City Council was the latest to request a mask mandate. That request was vetoed by Mayor Cafusi, the mayor of Provo City. And then last night, the council voted 6-1 to override her veto. So Provo will be the next city, it would appear, to get a mask mandate. The governor's now rejected one of these that's come from a local a city or a county council. And they appear to be the next in line.
Thank you, Robert, for your pick. Bethany Rogers, a short pick for underplayed story of the week.
Mine is Zach Podmore's article on County Seat, a television program that has been up to this point funded by taxpayer support from counties, but is now losing its support and is in danger of running out of funds.
Okay. And Taylor Stevens, your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, I'm going to highlight a piece from my colleague Alex Vahar. He wrote about RSL, Real Salt Lake owner Delroy Hansen's comments about the Real Salt Lake and LAFC's decision not to play their scheduled game on Wednesday night. So check that out for more.
Okay, sltrib.com for all of those stories. And for my part, I'm going to go with just the fact that the first week of school is now in the books for many students in Utah, and I won't highlight any single piece of coverage, but several stories from reporter Courtney Tanner that touch on that are worth checking out again at sltrib.com. Tribune reporters Taylor Stevens and Bethany Rogers and columnist Robert Gerke, all from the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you.
Yeah. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW, 88.3 FM here in Salt Lake City. You can join us next week for more conversations about Utah's news. And until then, I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. And you can find podcasts at kcpw.org.
This Week in This American Life, during a public meeting in Provo, Utah, here's how the audience reacted when a teacher testified that every student needed to wear a face mask to school.
It was just wild to be surrounded by so many grown adults who were shouting at me.
Yeah.
When school finally began, what happened? Did kids wear masks? This week.
Saturday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio is a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan. Also heard at UPR.org.
Utah State University welcomes the class of 2024 as they begin their Aggie journey. And to support appropriate distancing and other health protocols, Utah Public Radio will broadcast the live welcome from President Noel Cockett. He'll spend some time introducing students to USU traditions, including the Scotsman and I Believe chant. Parents, statewide students, and alumni, you're invited to join in for a special program broadcast Friday evening at 9 on Utah Public Radio.